Okay, well, first things first, happy birthday, David. So the first speaker of the morning session will be Roman Jakiv, a longtime friend and collaborator of David. And in fact, he will be speaking of recalling collaborations with David, the sentence of the chiral anomaly.
Thank you. Well, happy birthday, David. I am pleased to be the first celebrant of David's significant birthday, because among his colleagues and contemporaries and collaborators in physics, I probably have known David the longest, since the time we both left graduate school to become junior fellows at Harvard in 1966. There, our situation was not easy. Harvard physics was experiencing a downturn. Physics prominence at an institution undergoes cyclic variation like the economy. David was coming from Chu's S-matrix theory. I was coming from Wilson's field theory. Both Chu and Wilson were prophets, but not at that time at Harvard. Except perhaps for Schwinger, who was channeling both their ideas into his source theory under the motto, if you can't join him, beat him. Boston's theory seminar had lapsed. Weinberg had not yet arrived to invigorate the department. Now, a few miles away, MIT was bustling. The S-matrix was in vogue. Veneziano and Fubini were constructing the first version of the string model. I recall that David tried to make contact with that activity, but I guess it was just too wearisome to travel even the small distance between Harvard and MIT. And therefore, the two of us were thrown together onto our own resources. And if we were to collaborate with anyone, it had to be with each other. So we did, and I learned that David was smarter than I. This is because the only way our collaboration could proceed is either I learned S-matrix theory or he learned field theory. Now, at that time, there was no way I could learn S-matrix theory, and I still can't. As all of you know, David learned field theory. He learned it quickly, he learned it well, he contributed enormously to it, and then he left it for S-matrix theory in its newest incarnation. So our collaboration produced 7 papers, and here they are. Although Weinberg was not physically present, his influence is evident that all the papers deal in one way or another with currents and current algebra, subjects that were emphasized by Weinberg, whom David already knew in Berkeley. But looking at these papers again, I now see that the topics researched by us belong to the late Baroque period of current algebra, where the formalism became encrusted with various commutator and conservation anomalies, Schwinger terms, Siegel terms, and the like. Thus, papers 1 and 4, this one and this one, deal with Schwinger terms and Siegel terms, as does paper 3, where we use the Schwinger term in fermionic current commutators to fit the theory with Fermi fields into the Sugawara frame, a construction that later became very popular and was repeated many times. In paper 5, we again use the properties of the Schwinger term to give a estimate for the total electroproduction cross-section. And while the last paper, with Adler and Callan, uses, once again, anomalies, specifically the Adler-Bardeen non-renormalization theory, to prove that the Gell-Monlow function in electrodynamics doesn't have any zeros. Now, our most famous paper, where is it, this one? Spires, in fact, calls it a, what does it call it? It calls it renowned paper, and it concerns anomalies in the standard model. In fact, the collaboration was a long-distance one. We had left Harvard, David for Princeton, and I for MIT. The paper began as a separate, independent effort. I was finishing my manuscript while visiting the newly constituted theory group at Fermilab, and Treiman, its temporary leader, informed me that David was completing similar research. Joining our efforts turned out to be a great boon for me, because again, I benefited from David's positive approach. I had put forward the negative result that owing to the chiral anomaly, the Weinberg-Salam model was not renormalizable, contrary to Hooft's and Veltman's claims. While concurring, David put forward the positive principle of anomaly cancellation to save renormalizability. Thus, our work provides one of the two examples that not only theoretical physicists, but also nature, make use of the chiral anomaly, the other example being a neutral pion decay. Now, my favorite paper, in fact, is our second paper, which is not renowned. According to Spires, it is less than unknown. It is unlisted. Here we are recalling the famous Compton scattering low-energy theorems due to Tiering, Gell-Mann, Goldberger, and Lowe, which are a consequence of gauge invariance and are derived with the help of Ward identities. It seemed to us that diffeomorphism invariance should entail similar low-energy theorems for graviton scattering, but we did not know at that time how to derive the analogous Ward identities. Now, David's S-matrix expertise again made progress possible. It happened just in those days that Abarbanel and Goldberger re-derived the Compton scattering results using S-matrix dispersive methods. David suggested that we adopt that approach for our own graviton problem, and we succeeded in doing the impossible. We derived an exact result for quantum gravity, even though quantum gravity theory did not exist at that time, and perhaps still doesn't. Even after our physical collaboration ended, we continued to work together unconsciously, in spirit. Because 4 years later, after our last joint paper, David, together with Dashin and Callan, and I, together with Rebbe, produced identical analyses of the Yang-Mills vacuum and its angle. Now, probably David would prefer hearing about new results, while I have been reminiscing about old ones. So let me conclude with something that I hope he and all of you will find interesting. Now, by now, everyone appreciates that anomalous divergences of fermionic chiral currents involve topological Chern-Simons densities. In four dimensions, you have the abelian and the non-abelian densities associated with the triangle graph. In two dimensions, you just have the abelian one associated with the bubble. Now, these quantities, these Chern-Pontryagin densities, are topologically interesting, and their volume integrals are topological invariants, measuring various topological characteristics of gauge fields. Consequently, one expects that all these quantities can be presented as total derivatives, so that the volume integral becomes converted by Gauss's law into a surface integral, sensitive only to the long-distance global properties of the gauge fields, as befits a topological entity. And this is indeed the case. You can, in fact, write the Chern-Pontryagin densities as total derivatives. But in order to do that, you have to introduce potentials. You have to introduce vector potentials. So in the four-dimensional abelian case, you write f mu nu in the familiar curl of a vector potential. And then the anomaly, becomes clearly a total derivative. In the four-dimensional case, it's less trivial and less obvious, but if you write f mu nu in its non-abelian curl, then again the anomaly becomes a total derivative of this quantity. In two dimensions, the same holds in a very simple-minded way. This anomaly becomes this total derivative if you write f mu nu in the Maxwell curl. Now, the quantities whose divergences appear here are defined on odd-dimensional spaces because the Chern-Pontryagin quantities are defined in even-dimensional spaces, and they're called Chern-Simons terms. And by suppressing one dimension in these Chern-Simons terms, they become naturally defined on three manifolds or one manifold. Three manifolds for the four-dimensional case going down to the three-dimensional case, and the one on the line in the two-dimensional case going down to the one-dimensional case. Let's see, I want to put this up. So these are then the Chern-Simons densities, which are in one lower odd dimensions, abelian 3, non-abelian 3, abelian 1. Now the three and one dimensional volume integrals, of course in one dimension it's just a line integral, of these quantities are again topological invariants with interesting information. For example, the three-dimensional integral in the electromagnetic abelian context, A dot del cross A or A dot B, is called the magnetic helicity, and it measures the linkage of magnetic flux lines. An analogous quantity arises in fluid mechanics, with a fluid velocity dotted into the curl of the fluid velocity, and the curl of the fluid velocity is the vorticity. This quantity defines something which is called the kinetic vorticity. Now, as it happens, a non-vanishing kinetic vorticity presents an obstacle to the construction of a canonical formalism for the Euler equations of fluid mechanics. Yet another property of these Chern-Simons terms is that if you evaluate them on a vector potential, which is a pure gauge, they measure the winding number of the gauge function which enters in this pure gauge definition. Well, I'm not going to review here the many uses that arose after my colleagues and I introduced the abelian and non-abelian Chern-Simons terms about 20 years ago. The applications range from the mathematical characterization of knots to the physical description of electrons and the quantum Hall effect. And that's vivid evidence of the deep significance of these Chern-Simons structures and of their antecedent, the chiral anomaly. Instead, I want to pose the following question. Can one write these Chern-Simons terms as total derivatives so that, as befits a topological entity, the spatial volume integral becomes again a surface integral? An argument that it should be possible to do this is the following. The Chern-Simons terms that we have constructed are either three forms on three space or one form on one space. In other words, they're maximal. And by that I mean that their exterior derivatives vanish because there are no four forms on three space, nor are there any two forms on a line. And this establishes that the Chern-Simons terms are closed, and so one expects that they're also exact, at least locally. But in order to be written as total derivatives, which should be possible since they are locally exact, we have to introduce prepotentials for the vector potential because these formulas for the Chern-Simons terms don't show any obvious total derivative structure. And I remind you that these potentials had to be introduced to show that the Chern-Pontryagin densities are total derivatives. And so once again, if we want to go one step further and show that the Chern-Simons densities are total derivatives, we have to introduce potentials for the potentials, i.e. the prepotentials. Now there's actually a physical, practical reason for wanting the three-dimensional abelian Chern-Simons term to be a total derivative. As I mentioned, it's known in fluid mechanics that there exists an obstruction to the construction of a Lagrangian for Euler's fluid equations. And this obstruction is just the kinetic helicity, the spatial integral of V dot omega. And that's what we would call the volume integral of the abelian Chern-Simons term constructed from the velocity 3 vector. Now this obstruction is removed when the integrand, the Chern-Simons term, is a total derivative, because then the kinetic helicity volume integral is converted into a surface integral by Gauss's law, and when the integral gets contributions only from the surface, it no longer is acting in the bulk and the volume where the field equations, the fluid mechanical field equations, are acting, and the obstruction disappears. Now, in fact, it is easy to show that the abelian Chern-Simons term can be presented as a total derivative. In one dimension, it's especially easy because you can write any single function as a derivative of another function. In three dimensions, we have to use what's called the Clebsch parametrization for a 3-vector. The Clebsch parametrization for a 3-vector is writing a 3-vector in this form, kind of gauge part, and then this additional expression. This decomposition of a 3-vector is different from the one we are conventionally used to, which decomposes a 3-vector into a gauge part, a longitudinal part, and a transverse part, and a transverse vector. But here what we have is 3 scalars. The Clebsch parametrization was introduced by Clebsch in the 19th century, and he showed how you construct this representation. In modern terminology, you can view this as a statement of Darboux's theorem, which says that a one form can be written as an exact expression plus this coexact term here. With this parametrization for the vector potential, one easily sees that the abelian Chern-Simons term is indeed a total derivative. Because remember, the abelian Chern-Simons term is A dot del cross A. Del cross A from this expression will just be grad alpha cross grad beta. And then when you dot A into it, only the grad theta portion contributes. And therefore, you can take out the gradient, and you can write the abelian Chern-Simons density as a total derivative. This produces a rather elegant formula for the magnetic helicity. It says that the integral A dot B from this expression is just the flux through the bounding surface modulated by this function theta. When the Clebsch parametrization is employed for V in the for the velocity in the fluid dynamical context, as I said, the obstruction to a canonical formulation is removed. And therefore, the situation is rather similar to the force law, Lorentz force law in electrodynamics. You know that the Lorentz force law in electrodynamics is written just in terms of field strengths. However, in order to give a Lagrangian formulation for it, you have to introduce potentials. So similarly, the Euler equations can be written in terms of the velocity, but in order to give a Lagrangian formulation for the Euler equations, you have to introduce potentials for the velocity. You have to introduce the Clebsch potentials. This, by the way, was established by my colleague C.C. Lin in the 50s. Now, it is a natural generalization to ask, can one find a parametrization in 3 dimensions of the non-abelian vector potential such that the non-abelian Chern-Simons term also is a total derivative? It turns out that this is possible. The construction is technical. It takes a little while to present it, so I won't present it here, and those of you who might be interested in it can read about it in the paper written by So-Young P, Nair, and me, where we gave the construction in 3 dimensions. In other words, what we were constructing is the non-abelian generalization of the Clebsch parametrization, where by Clebsch parametrization we mean that parametrization which makes the Chern-Simons volume integral equal to a surface integral. Well, just as the Clebsch parametrization in the abelian case is useful for a Lagrangian formulation of fluid mechanics, we are hopeful that our presentation of the non-abelian Chern-Simons term as a total derivative will be useful in a formulation of non-abelian fluid mechanics, a fluid mechanics that may very well be relevant to QCD plasmas and the like. Thank you. Well, I could. I can't really flash the formula because it's not a simple formula. No, I really can't flash it. It takes quite a while to present it. Basically, it's the following. We have to embed. Well, the first thing I have to tell you, I mean, this gets very technical, and I think I will stop very soon. The first thing I have to tell you is another point of view about the abelian case. Rather than taking the presentation of the abelian formula as given by Clebsch, one can say the following. Consider a pure gauge within SU2, G inverse DG. Project that pure gauge in the three direction. That gives you an electromagnetic function, electromagnetic vector potential, which is not a pure gauge electromagnetically. It's a pure gauge non-abelian, but as an abelian vector potential, it's not a pure gauge. Moreover, it has sufficient number of parameters to represent an arbitrary vector potential, because SU2 has three parameters, and a vector potential has three parameters. So what I'm telling you is a presentation of an arbitrary abelian vector potential is to begin in SU2 and project SU2 onto the abelian direction. Now it turns out that that is the idea behind the non-abelian generalization. You have to start with a bigger group, which contains the group that you're interested in. The subgroup is H is embedded in G, but you really are interested in H. There has to be this symmetric space structure for the embedding of H in G. And once you have this, then the vector potential that you construct within H, what you're interested in, is the projection of a pure gauge within G onto the direction H. And one can prove that this formula for the non-abelian vector potential is a completely general formula. It has enough parameters to satisfy all the requirements, and moreover, that it leads to a Chern-Simons term, which is a total derivative. This actually raises an interesting possibility. If you think that the universe before the phase transition was populated by pure gauge, pure non-abelian gauge, at the phase transition, this pure non-abelian gauge could have frozen into, let's say, the three direction, producing an electromagnetic field, which is not a pure electromagnetic thing. Not only is it not a pure electromagnetic thing, but one can also prove, and I didn't prove it here, that the non-abelian Chern-Simons pure gauge number, which is the winding number of that pure gauge function, which you're using to construct the abelian gauge field, that winding number is equal to the magnetic helicity. So what I just told you is how to construct an arbitrary magnetic field with magnetic helicity, with a given magnetic helicity. The way you construct it is you begin with an SU2 with a pure gauge of winding number n. You take that pure gauge formula in SU2, project it on the third direction, use that vector potential to define an abelian magnetic field, and then the winding number of that magnetic abelian field is the winding number of the non-abelian pure gauge. And that generalizes into this non-abelian construction as well. Well, no, it's not all that similar because the quantum edge states have to be constructed from the anomaly, right?
Well, there and given turn time is actually
right.
And somehow it's just the total derivative part which governs the
magnetic. Right.
Is that the same problem?
No, I don't think so because what governs the edge dynamics. I mean, what you have is that you have the Chern-Simons term in the bulk, okay? That is not gauge invariant. So you look how that transforms under a gauge transformation, that bulk term. And when you're integrating over the bulk, the only thing that survives is the surface term. So the surface term is not the Chern-Simons term itself, it's the response of the Chern-Simons term to the gauge transformation. And then what you do is you find on the boundary some structure which also is non-gauge invariant, which produces the same response as you've gotten from integrating the bulk. And that structure is just a two-dimensional chiral fermion, because that has its own anomaly, and that anomaly is a total derivative, which equals to the total derivative, but which wasn't an arbitrary Chern-Simons term, but just the gauge transform of a Chern-Simons term. So it's a little bit different, but they are certainly related, and in fact, that's how we got started on figuring out how to do this from that kind of relation.
Thank you.